the road must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked.
Welcome to this May 29th, 2018 edition of Education Now. In this edition, I welcome Teacher of the Year Mandy Manning. According to her application form for the Teacher of the Year Award, Manny is the first teacher her students have after they arrive in the U.S. Welcome to the podcast airwaves of Education Now, Mandy.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's such a pleasure. I want our listeners to know that Mandy teaches English and math to refugee and immigrant students in the Newcomer Center at Ferris High School in Spokane, Washington, where she is her students' first teacher once they arrive in the U.S., which is something amazing to me, and so timely because of everything that's happening in this country. I understand, Mandy, that you didn't always want to be a teacher.
No, I did not start out to be a teacher. Mm-mm. I started out to be a filmmaker, actually. I wanted to be a screenwriter and a producer.
Yeah.
But after I did that for a little while, I just found that I didn't quite have the personality for that line of work, and I stumbled into teaching via being a paraeducator. So I was a paraeducator for a year in a special education classroom, and then a couple of years in the Peace Corps. And then I headed down to Texas, and that's where I was able to become a full-time classroom teacher, and I got my certification. And I found that working with young people and seeing all the potential out there on their faces and just helping guide them to being, you know, awesome human beings was such a privilege, and it gave me such purpose. And so I've been doing it for 19 years now.
Yes, that's just awesome. I guess you've really, in that you talked about your experience in the Peace Corps, but if there's anything else you'd like to add regarding your experience in the Peace Corps, please do. And you live in Spokane, Washington now. And when did you move to Spokane, and why did you move?
So I'll start with the Peace Corps a little bit. So I had always thought about being in the Peace Corps. I don't really know why. Like, I don't even know how I even knew about the Peace Corps, but I did. And I had thought about it all through high school and everything. But I just, I don't know. Things like that come and go. And then when I didn't want to work in TV news or be a filmmaker anymore, I was like, well, what am I going to do? And I thought, oh my gosh, I've always wanted to be in the Peace Corps. And so I applied to the Peace Corps, and that actually was one of the most profound experiences of my life, because I'd moved, you know, we'd moved several times in my life, but I had never fully left home or gone someplace that was drastically different from my own experiences, and the Peace Corps was that. I mean, I went overseas to Armenia, and originally I didn't even know very much about the country of Armenia, and so here I was, you know, I was only 22 years old, and I was in this whole different, you know, environment. There were different people and different culture and different experiences and ways of thinking and being and doing, and it really took a lot of adjusting and accepting of others,
and the language wasn't a barrier for you.
Well, it was, because I didn't know Armenian, but the Peace Corps is really good. We have 3 months of training before you even start working on your own in the Peace Corps. And a lot of that is intensive language training. So by the time I went to the village where I was working, I knew quite a bit of Armenian and could hold my own. You know, I could go shopping and I could meet my neighbors and do all of that stuff. But it was just so profound for me, though. And I've carried that experience with me throughout the rest of my career, because we need to be adaptable and we need to be willing to immerse ourselves in things that are different from what we've experienced in order to broaden our perspectives and help us to be more open and frankly, just happier. Like, I just being able to welcome other people and to be willing to get to know people who are different from me, it just makes me a happier person because I'm not fearful. I invite that new experience. And so that's what the Peace Corps did for me. Really, I believe that the Peace Corps propelled me into my position that I'm in now.
Yeah, the Peace Corps to me, because I'm much older than you are, Mandy, was started by John F. Kennedy, and it was a way to serve, but not in a not killing people. You know, like, instead of serving in the military, why not serve for peace? And at that same time, there was an organization in Service to America. Mm-hmm. And I love the idea, but I've always loved America, and so that was what I was going to do. And then I was in college at the time, and then the man that I was dating proposed to me, and I loved him, and so I made the choice to get married instead of go in service to America, where I had been accepted, which was neat, and I would have been serving in the Chicago area. So I do understand that service to is. Now, why did you move to Spokane?
So after I was in the Peace Corps, I taught for 4 years in Texas, which I have to say, just piggybacking on what you said about the service to America, you know, we have AmeriCorps, which is, that probably was service to America. It's probably changed into AmeriCorps, which is like the American Peace Corps.
That's right.
And I have to say that serving in your own nation it can be equally as challenging and rewarding, because we're not all the same. You know, if we live in Texas, we're very different than if we live in Washington and New York or Illinois or any of the states. So, there's so much to be said about being of service to others here in the United States and then also abroad. But so going to the Spokane thing, so after Peace Corps, I went to Texas, which was an equally challenging experience. Like I said, there was a lot of culture shock in that way too, because I was moving to another state that was far from Washington. And then I went to Japan for a couple of years, which was also awesome, and New York. And then when I was in New York, my family decided that maybe someone needed to come here and live with my grandpa. And I didn't have children at the time or anything like that. So I was like, well, you know, I can do that. And so I came back to Spokane, and it was contingent, of course, on me being able to find a teaching position. And I was able to find a teaching position, teaching video productions at Lewis and Clark High School in Spokane. And so I came back to be with my grandpa, and that actually only lasted about 8 months. Because we determined that he just needed a little bit more support during the day, because I had to work, and so that was not super helpful. But I was here for my grandpa, right. And that was amazing, because I got to spend time with him, and I ended up using some of my video skills, and I made a little video of him telling all of his stories. He was a tremendous storyteller. And right. So I came back for him, and ended up finding a job in video, but then also making my way into the English language development program. And I've since, you know, it's now been 10 years I've been here. I've gotten married. I have a child and two stepchildren. and I have roots. I already had roots here because I had gone to elementary school here in Spokane. Mm-hmm. And so,
were you born in Washington?
Actually, I was born in Portland, Oregon.
Uh-huh. Oh, how wonderful.
Yeah.
Oh, what a wonderful story. I mean, you've adopted children. You had a child of your own, and you're doing such great work. Well, can you tell our listeners about the Newcomer Center?
So, Newcomer Center is a specialized English language development program for brand new immigrant and refugee students to our nation. So these are students who've been in our nation for usually three months or fewer, and they have almost no English language ability. Like they've learned very little English in their formal education, or they just haven't had very much formal education. And so they come to the United States and they come to my classroom if they're of high school age. So we have two newcomer centers in Spokane. The other one is a middle school newcomer center, so it's for kids who are of middle school age, and that just started this last year. But the newcomer center in which I teach has been around in various iterations since 1997. Uh-huh. And so students spend, and they come from all, the reason I say it's for all high school age students is because it doesn't matter what their neighborhood high school is, if they fall under the category of a newcomer, how we define it, mm-hmm. then they come to the newcomer center first. And they spend a semester to a year with me, and we learn reading and writing. We learn English language development, so the foundational language that they need in order to be successful in their classrooms. And then also we do the language for math.
And what is your classroom like? Is it a hands-on? Are you giving them hands-on experience? Are there manipulatives? Is there movement? Or is it really sit at your desk and, you know, listen and a board and chalkboard and, you know, working like that?
Well, it's definitely not a sit-and-get classroom because you have to experience language to truly develop it. Mm-hmm. And so we do a lot of hands-on. We do a lot of experiential learning in context. And I just want to also say that, so teach the foundational components of language that the students need is definitely not like our most important thing that we do in the Newcomer Center. The most important thing that we do is acclimate the students to their new culture, to the new culture in which they are going to now live. And so what that means is easing the transition into being a student in the United States, because most of them have not done that before. And also learning how to maintain their own culture, but also live within the new culture. Right. And adapt, you know, adapt to new surroundings and learn how to maneuver and navigate within their new community. And make friends and connections, and to not only help them to ease into being a student in the United States, but also to help the students born in the United States accept and connect with these new people.
Right.
So we do a lot of connections between classrooms.
Unity within diversity.
Right.
They keep the diversity. But mm-hmm. but there's unity in the diversity. There's respect
right.
for one another's differences. There isn't like change and be like us. There's, you know, like we, you know, everybody be themselves and love yourself and, you know, good self-concept.
Right.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, but
very holistic.
But be willing to reach across that difference and make connections regardless and accept one another and celebrate one another.
Right. Well, I understand that you lead a diverse committee in reevaluating your school's discipline plan and adopting an evidence-based behavioral intervention plan that enhanced academic and social behavior outcomes for all students.
So what happened is that we had a district-wide push around discipline back in the spring of 2016, because what we were finding was that we were not being very effective with our discipline. And plus, the language that was in our collective bargaining agreement didn't match with what we were doing in our building. And we were also seeing that our discipline, the plan that we had in action, was disproportionately impacting our students of color, which I think is the case in most areas, actually, not just in our school. But
you're sort of a microcosm of what was is national.
Right. And so I can't, of course, claim that it was all me, because it wasn't. What happened was I noticed this issue, and I used the fact that the collective bargaining language didn't match with what we were doing as kind of a jumping off of a meeting with the administrative team. And I had a meeting with them, and I said, you know, I think part of the problem is that people don't really understand what our discipline plan is. They don't know their own roles and responsibilities. And I said, additionally, you know, we're not including all of the voices within our building, because discipline is one of those things that it doesn't just impact students. It impacts educators. It impacts paraeducators. It impacts custodial staff, secretary, clerical, like every single nutrition services, all of it. And so I said, why don't we, you know, we'll just, you know, right now we're going to draw a line and we're going to decide, okay, what happened, and now we need to move forward with something different. And so let's convene all the stakeholders and develop a new discipline plan that everybody has a say in, and that we all understand what we're supposed to be doing. And so, and, you know, it was all around these restorative practices and the positive behavior intervention systems and all of that, which is really couched in cultural responsiveness and cultural, you know, being able to be culturally responsive when approaching any kind of, well, anything really, any element of education. And so what we did, we just invited everybody and we made sure that we had a representative from every single stakeholder group within our building. And some couldn't attend the meeting, so we would do like a liaison thing where we would report to them and then they would give us feedback and then we would incorporate that feedback. And we together as a group developed a new plan, and we had that plan ready to go the year 2016-17. And we started the year with some training that would help everybody know what they were, you know, their roles and responsibilities and how the discipline plan would work. And that first year we saw a 74% decrease in suspensions, because we were implementing some new and different approaches to consequences, right?
Right.
So instead of sending kids out of the building, we were helping them within our building. But the real key was that everybody understood what they were supposed to be doing.
Yes.
Including custodians and nutrition services and secretary clerical. You know, like the sometimes we take for granted that everybody just is working together. But we forget that in order for all of us to work together, we all need to be at the table communicating our needs.
Yeah.
And so that's what we did. And I, you know, that first year was amazing. We had amazing results. But it is hard to maintain those results. And so it's really important that plan be fluid and be adaptable, so that because the demographics change every single year, and we, you know, we have people leave and come and go. And so this year we've implemented culturally responsive classroom management, which is a training program put on by our Washington Education Association.
Right.
And that has helped a lot, because sometimes the positive behavior intervention systems and the restorative practices can be really like theoretical and we need to have a framework. So culturally responsive classroom management has helped us have that framework. But it's a struggle every year, and we have to stay committed to the work. And I'm not in the building right now, so when I left, there was a really strong team, and so I'm hopeful that we'll be able to continue to have positive impacts on kids. The next step is, of course, to include student voice, because student voice is so essential as well.
Oh, yes, that's really important. I think it's wonderful that flexibility is built into this plan. That the flexibility is wonderful, because it's when people become so rigid, like a formula, that I think that it loses its humanity. But So that's beautiful, what's happening. Well, I just loved reading about you as Teacher of the Year, and I loved watching the video. So can you tell our listeners, what are your priorities as National Teacher of the Year, Mandy?
So my first priority is to focus on building strong communities. And that's because I often use the phrase of be fearless, be kind, get to know your neighbor. And so this is really about intentionally seeking experiences outside of our understanding in order to be better at making connections with one another. And what's so interesting about that is that I just read an article just yesterday in The Week. Do you know that publication, The Week?
Yes.
And it was about happiness. And it was talking specifically about how disconnected we are as a society and how isolated and alone a lot of us feel. And that is a direct result of, keeping ourselves isolated from one another. Like, we feel isolated, but we are also, we're culpable in that, because we keep ourselves isolated. We build fences instead of bridges. We don't know our neighbors anymore.
Yes.
We're reluctant to meet new people. And so that's my very first and most, the thing that I focus on the most is that whole idea of making connections and building community. And that starts in schools. It starts in homes and in schools. And I think it's important that our schools become community centers. And so that's one of them. The second one is, go ahead.
I was just going to say that I totally agree with you, and that Joy Turner, who was my mentor and on the board of American Montessori Society, had done research. And, so she said, small is beautiful, and that these large schools and these large class sizes were, especially during adolescence, where we're creating this alienation, where it created alienation, because this was at a time when this existential angst exists anyway, and then to build into that this isolating kind of environment instead of small and open and communicative. And so I just wanted to support your gut on that, on what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah. And I actually teach in a large comprehensive high school. And I think you can create community within a large comprehensive high school. But I think that the key that you mentioned was class size.
Right.
Because when you have, 30 plus kids in a room, it really hinders a teacher's ability to build relationships, but then also to encourage students to build relationships with one another, because there's just so many bodies in a room,
right,
and so little time. Yeah, so most classes, are only an hour long. So at the secondary level.
Right. So, but the consciousness, if the consciousness is there, then, then there will be actions within that context to make these connections happen, and
right, yeah,
that's
the
wonderful
intentionality.
Right.
The intentionality. You have to, you yourself have to, like every person, I believe, needs to intentionally place themselves in situations and have experiences that are outside of their understanding in order to broaden perspective and to bring clarity. And then I think then in turn, we need to provide those experiences and opportunities for our young people so that they learn very young that, because they do, they instinctively do that anyway. We just, as a society, encourage them to be fearful instead of open and interested in other people. And so we need to continue intentionally to help them to maintain that curiosity and that openness to others.
Yes, I just so totally agree with you. Yes. And now, was there any more answer to that question of what your priorities were? Did you get the second one out?
No. So my second one is about leveraging teacher leadership, because I think so. Oftentimes, what we're talking about when we're talking about teacher leadership is like mentor teacher or curriculum, you know, creating curriculum or doing things like that. And also trying to have a voice in policy and things like that. But I think we need to take it a step further with teacher leadership. I think we need to provide educators an opportunity to be teacher leaders and to be compensated for that. So that's all the aspects of teacher leadership, like curriculum. It could be curriculum, curriculum or instructional leader, it could be mentor teacher, it could be building leader. I mean, there's so many different things. And then also at the policy level, and I'm not just talking federal policy or state policy, I'm also talking about local policy, because really the decisions that districts make are far more impactful on the classroom than what we see at the state or the federal level. Because it's about how interpretation of the federal and the state laws, how that actually plays out in the districts. And so I think we need to be focusing on how do we get more educators involved in those decision making, in the decision making, so that they can provide that real view of how it impacts the classroom and what policy looks like in our classrooms and how it either helps or hinders. You know, whether it becomes a barrier or provides space for instruction, and particularly in terms of equity. And so that means not only sharing our voice, but being actually active in that process, where we're not only invited to the table to speak, but to actually work and be part of it.
Mm-hmm.
My train of thought kind of wandered off there.
Well, but, that's okay.
So yeah.
To be a part of it, to not only report on it, but be a part of the solution. Not only describe the problem, but help provide the solution. You know, with ideas and time. Right?
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, hands-on. And I think we also need to be opening our classroom doors. We have a tendency as educators to shut our door and just do what we do in our classrooms, which is great, because our biggest impact, of course, is on our students, of course. But we also need to be opening our doors. We need to be seeking help from other educators if we have areas of weakness. And we also need to be willing to have other educators come in and observe us, because we also have a lot to teach.
Yes.
I welcome
observation when I was, you know, in the classroom, but there were certain things, you know, if you came to observe, you were to observe. You were not to interact with the students or try to interact with me while I was teaching. You were to observe, right? And then we could talk. We could talk afterwards. But if you've come to observe, you know, you've not come to interact. You know, that's a different thing. If you want to interact, well, then say I want to come and somehow participate in your classroom. That's different than saying I want to observe. Anyway,
right?
You hit
yeah.
up.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Well, when President Trump gave you your award, was U.S. Secretary of State Betsy DeVos present?
Yeah, she was. She was standing right next to me.
And did she say anything to you, or?
Well, we actually had an opportunity to, as the State Teachers of the Year, so as the 55 State Teachers of the Year, we had a listening session with Betsy, with Secretary DeVos on Monday, the Monday of that week.
Yeah.
And that experience was, a lot of news outlets suggested that it was very combative, and it really wasn't. It wasn't, you know, verbal sparring or arguing with one another. What it was, here's the secretary with a room full of mostly public education educators who were communicating with her the issues facing our schools and how her current way of thinking and policies were negatively impacting their classrooms.
Right.
And so that has to be kind of intimidating for the secretary when it's just her, you know, with these 55 teachers. But everybody is communicating their, you know, concerns and observations and suggestions, because you can't just communicate concerns, you have to communicate suggestions. And what we saw from her, and this may have been some defensiveness, some apprehension, some anxiety, but we saw her just repeating mainly her talking points about school choice and about ensuring that parents have a choice and, you know, all of these, you know, just her talking points.
Her mantra.
Really not communicating, listening.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
And really not listening
right.
to what we were saying. And so that was a kind of a disappointing.
Right. I mean, you know,
then,
as a teacher,
on,
as a teacher, you know, as a teacher, reflective listening is essential. And
yes.
there she was. There she was with a room full of you. Who knew, mm-hmm. who know what teaching is, demonstrating that she was unable.
Yes.
To do the most fundamental thing, which was to listen reflectively to what others are saying.
Yes.
Oh, yes. Man, I don't think it's reactive. I think, oh man, I would. Oh.
Well, but then on the Wednesday, we had another opportunity to meet with her, and this time it was on a panel. So the four finalists for National Teacher of the Year were able to sit on a panel with Secretary DeVos and also Secretary of Labor Acosta. And we discussed some really important issues facing education, safety, and the opioid crisis, and just various other things that impact classrooms. And that was a lot more candid of a discussion. I cannot say that we had an opportunity to really communicate our ideas and thoughts around education. I cannot, of course, say whether or not she listened at that time either, because it wasn't like that. It was a panel in front of an audience. And so, but she was cordial and she was polite and pleasant. But yeah, I don't know that she listens.
If she had, then you'd see that would be reflected in some action that she took afterwards.
Yeah.
And it
right.
isn't.
Right. And yeah.
And
no,
it isn't.
I haven't seen anything, happen as a result of our communicating
right.
with her. No.
No. That's the thing. She has an agenda, and it's certainly not the well-being of children, in my opinion,
yeah.
or of all children.
I did extend to her after the ceremony. I said, I'm really serious. I would love to have an opportunity to sit down and talk with you more. I think that we have some things that we should talk about, and it's important to include teachers in the conversation. And she smiled and nodded. And so,
I'm sorry. It's just that when you said smiled and nodded, I just thought of that, you know, denial. You know, how you just turn it off and you smile and nod. And
That's why it's so very important that we continue. We must continue, even if there's no indication that anyone is listening, or because there are a lot of people listening. And at the end of the day, Secretary DeVos, while she might be in that position, not forever, and we can make so much of an impact right here locally. And so we must continue to be positive and to focus and tell our messages and advocate for our students.
Right, we must. And I think that a lot of what teachers did in Arizona, in West Virginia, in Oklahoma, with their getting out in the streets in North Carolina, you know, these states that, you know, are not these liberal, bastions, but, yep, you know, red states. I think that was saying to the nation something so profound, because Betsy DeVos is supposed to be, you know, I don't know what that tinkling is. Is it ice?
Oh, no, it was. Sorry, it was a wind chime.
A wind chime, okay. Yeah. I don't know, you know, but I do feel that what people have done with these demonstrations, what teachers have done, what they're doing, is showing the nation that these supposedly red states that are supposedly, you know, conservative, which is, you know, Betsy DeVos and Trump, they don't agree, because the communities were supporting those teachers. And so that gives me great hope. Well, tell our listeners what pins and symbols you were wearing when you received the award, and why you chose to wear them.
So So I teach, first of all, we know this, I teach immigrant and refugee students. And I also have been one of the co-advisors for the Gay Straight Alliance at our school. And I also coach girls basketball and have had one transgender boy on my girls basketball team, because we are the way we are as a society right now. And so it was very important to me as I went into that particular White House, because we know that many of those students that I just mentioned feel extremely marginalized, extremely vulnerable, dismissed, vilified by this current administration. And it was very important to me that my students knew, as I stood up there in that particular space, that I was there for them, and that I was there to be a voice for them, to advocate for them, and to, share their messages. And, of course, I brought the letters also for the president from my immigrant and refugee kids. And so as I thought about this visit, and how it was going to impact my students to see me standing up there with, you know, in this place at this time, that I needed to communicate to them that they were there with me and that I was there for them. And so I used pins to do that. So I had my Peace Corps pin, which for me represented my refugee kids. I had my Shepherd Fairey pin it was originally for the Women's March, but it represented the Dreamers and the DACA immigrants.
Yes.
Pin. And then I had my Trans Equality Now pin for my transgender students, and my apple that was Rainbow Apple for my LGBTQ, kids. And so I wore pins that I knew would communicate that it would maintain my integrity in that environment and also show my kids that this is for them and that my platform is for them, and that I will do everything I can to communicate what beautiful, amazing, focused, dedicated, awesome human beings they are.
I was so proud of you. I just cried. It was just so moving to me. I just thank you so much. I just felt like you were doing it for all of us. For all of us who, you know, don't have a platform, don't have a megaphone. It was just, oh gosh, just thank you so much, Mandy.
Well, it's truly my pleasure. Like, I feel so strongly about all of this, and I feel so strongly that we need to be compassionate and empathetic, and we need to make connections, and that's who we are. That's who we are as a nation, and it's upsetting to me that we can divide ourselves this way, and we just need to stop it.
Right. So is that what your advice would be to those who teach in public schools during this critical time for public education? Do you have any specific thing, words for them, aside from, you know, I mean, there was a lot of meat in what you've said so far, if they were looking for direction, but do you have anything more to say about, you know, for them?
I just encourage them to build community, to really look at their students and what their students need to grow, to become, you know, amazing community members. Look at what they need and do what they need and advocate for what they need. And because there's always going to be things that come down the pipe that they say, you need to do this for your students, and you have to do it at this time and on this page and on this day. And we have to, as educators, say no. We need to say no, because these are my kids. I know my kids, and this is what my kids need. And so I'm going to do this, and this is why. Because if we're always communicating about our classrooms with students at the center of that message, no one can argue with us, because we know our kids,
right.
And we need to be brave, and we need to use our collective voice to say, this is what's best for kids, and so this is what I'm going to do. And that's not going to look the same in every single community, because not every single community needs the same thing.
Right.
And so we need to stop with that business. And this, frankly, is not just for public schools. It's for any teacher, any educator in any classroom needs to be thinking about their kids first.
That's right. I agree with you. They are the priority. Oh, all right. And what about, do you have some advice for parents?
Yes. I encourage parents to, first of all, come into the schools. All the schools. Don't just go to your kid's school, but go to a lot of schools. See what's happening in all the schools, because there are amazing things and amazing educators and amazing students in every single school. So go out and see what's happening for real. Second, communicate with your teachers and accept that your child is going to act differently in different situations. So sometimes a child's teacher is going to see a different version of your child than you see at home. And it's really important that you communicate both of that. So like if your teacher reaches out about something, accept it and talk through it and help one another. And same, if something's happening at home, reach out to the teacher and say, hey, I'm seeing this. Because two-way communications is the only way it's going to work, because we truly are a team in ensuring success for children.
Yes, yes, that's beautiful.
And so, yeah, and then I think also in the elementary school, we see a lot of involvement by parents. You know, parents are always volunteering, they're
right.
Going on field trips, they're doing all kinds of things, helping all throughout the school. And then that slowly diminishes over time. And then it becomes something different in high school. Like we have a really strong parent-teacher group at Ferris. And their main focus is this big fundraiser, which I understand, you know, that the needs of a student change, but the needs of teachers don't change. And so we all need classroom support. So go, you know, just like you used to give classroom support in the elementary school, go up to the high school and see which teachers need classroom support. And it doesn't necessarily need to be your kid's classroom. It could be the English language learning classroom. It could be a science classroom. It could be a classroom where you just happen to have a special skill that that classroom might need. And be visible. Be visible in your kid's life. That doesn't mean you have to be right in their classroom and right in their face. It just means that you're around and they know you're around.
Right. They know that you're watching and that you care.
Right. And this is the most important piece. This is the most important piece. Because we need to understand that all parents want what's best for their kids. Some parents don't necessarily have the tools to be able to, you know, be advocates for their kids or to, you know, read to their kids every day or to do all the things that we say all parents need to do. They also oftentimes don't have the time to be a participant in like a PTA or a PTG. A parent-teacher group. And so we need to, those parents who do have that ability and do have those tools need to be more open to engaging those parents who aren't as willing to participate. And we need to figure out what will work. How can we get all of the all parents involved? What could that look like? How can we make more flexible schedules? How can we communicate better? Because if all you're doing is sending out emails, there are parents who don't have email.
Right. You need to find a way.
If all you're doing is sending robocalls. Yeah.
Yeah. We need to find a way to empower all the parents.
Right.
Because that will empower the children. Yes, I agree with you. Well, what are your feelings regarding the Trump administration separating migrant children from their parents? I heard about this on NPR this past Sunday, and it was featured in a New York Times article on April 20th titled, "Hundreds of Immigrant Children Have Been Taken from Parents at U.S. Border." And then today, I heard news about a young Guatemalan girl on her way to meet her boyfriend here in America, and she was shot in the head by an immigration official. This was reported in The Guardian and also on Democracy Now! Today, Mandy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this situation of separating children from their parents, I think, is really devastating. I just think everybody should reach into their whether you're a parent or not, all of us have been born of someone, right? We have parents, whether they're the parents who birthed us or adoptive parents or, you know, whatever situation. People need to think about what that means. Like, I cannot imagine, as both a parent and a child, being separated. I cannot imagine being separated from my child, and I can't imagine as a child being separated from my parent. And what we don't think about is, what are these people fleeing in order to try to come here to the United States? Like, what is the situation in their country that is making it intolerable for them to live there? Because no person wants to actually leave their home.
Right.
They don't. And we need to recognize that. They're not coming here because, you know, for nefarious reasons. Usually, especially if they're coming with their children, it's for some sort of protection. They're leaving something that's terrible. They don't have a situation where they can effectively meet the needs of their kids. So that's why they're coming to the United States.
Right.
And then to come here and to have their children taken from them, and in some cases, they're not ever reunited with one another because the parents are being prosecuted or have been deported. And then you have these unaccompanied minors at this point because they've been separated from parents. That's not going to be good for anybody. That's not going to be good for the child. It's not going to be good for the parents. And frankly, it's not good for the United States, because then we have a situation where there's unaccompanied minors that now are the responsibility of the state.
Yeah.
So it doesn't work in any situation. And I believe what the attempt is, it's a deterrent, because they're saying, if you come here, we're going to take your kids. And to me, that's just so...
un-American. It's so un-American.
It's sad to me. And
to feel that those words are coming out of someone who represents my country, it breaks my heart. Thank you for your words, Mandy. Now I want to let everyone know that some websites that are relevant to this interview are one called titled U.S. Teacher of the Year Stages Silent Protest as Trump Awards Prize, and that was a Guardian article in mm-hmm. May 2018, May 2nd. And then there's another one, She Didn't Always Want to Be a Teacher. Now this Washington educator is National Teacher of the Year. And so that was that's from the Seattle Times. And then I also have a link, a listed for everyone who gets the promotion, 2018 National Teacher of the Year finalist. And that'll give you, a biography on Mandy and all other kinds of things that you would possibly want to know. And then the Council of Chief State School Officers, which is, can you talk a little bit about what is the Council of Chief State School Officers?
So that is the group that all of the state superintendents are a part of. And so, like in Washington State, our superintendent is Chris Rakedahl, so he's a part of that organization. And all the other state superintendents are part of that organization, and they come together. And they are... they do advocacy, of course, for whatever it's like any other education association, kind of, because they have their areas that they focus on during the year and then try to work on. But it's comprised of the superintendents.
Right. Well, I wanted to list that on the promotion and I've got the Wikipedia a link for it, because when I was talking about this interview, people said to me, "Oh, aren't those the people that make support the testing? Isn't that they do the testing there?" And I was like, "No, I wanted to be sure to put that out there. And then another one, the one I just mentioned, hundreds of immigrant children have been taken from parents at U.S. border. That's the New York Times, and that was on April 20th of this year. And I want
I just wanted to say one thing, because people are getting the confused. This is important. People are getting confused between the 100 children that the U.S. government doesn't know where they are.
Right.
And then the kids who are being separated from their parents at the border. Those are two very separate things. And I just want to state that the kids who are, that the government doesn't know where they are, it's because they are living with a relative or someone else. It's not because the government was just like, they were just lost.
Right.
It's because they went to live with someone whom they had some sort of a connection with, and then the government no longer tracks them, which is actually probably a good thing.
Right.
And so I think it's really important to make that differentiation, that these kids that there's a reason the government doesn't know where they are.
Right.
And it's because they're likely living with family members.
Right.
Whereas these kids being separated from their parents at the border is a whole different issue. And I just want to make sure that we're not connecting those
conflating those two. Thank you for
right.
Thank you for that clarity, Mandy. I think that was very important. I also want our listeners to know that you can listen and download free anytime at our website, and please join us on Education Now's Facebook page to leave comments and join the conversation. Now, Mandy, did you want to leave a contact, or is, you know, if people just comment on it wherever it's posted, you'll see the comments and you can interact there, or do you want to leave an actual contact?
So my official email address for a National Teacher of the Year is NTOY, so NTOY, 2018 at ccsso.org, and people can contact me that way. Hopefully it's positive communication.
Okay, so it is now. Give us, what is the beginning of that? M what?
No, N, National. So it's National Teacher of the Year, NTOY. So just the initials, for, like the an acronym for National Teacher of the Year.
NTOY. Uh-huh.
2018, so 2018.
Mm-hmm. CCSSO.org.
Yes.
NTOY, 2018, CCSSO.org is the contact
right.
for Mandy if you want to connect with her personally.
Right.
And Education Now is a production of the Hermeneutic Institute for Holistic Health and Education, a 501c3 nonprofit corporation. And we're also proud supporters, pardon me, of the American Montessori Society. Thank you so very much, Mandy, for taking the time to talk with me this morning.
And absolutely my pleasure.
And thank your family for sharing you with us. I know that I didn't tell our listeners that, pardon me again, Mandy enjoys hiking and camping with her family. Is that right, Mandy?
Yes, I do. Very much, yes.
Well, you thank them for sharing you with me. And thank you so much for being alive and for the work that you're doing.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Who are on the road must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you love.